Welcome to Artists and Ancestors, a podcast where we explore ways to research and understand the past. Whether you're a local historian, genealogist, or just interested in learning about the everyday creative lives of people and the things that they made, this program is for you. I'm John Kay, your host of Artists and Ancestors. Hello and welcome to this episode 22 of Artists and Ancestors, Why the Creative Commons. In this episode, I sit down and talk with my friend and fellow folklorist, Jason Jackson, to discuss the topic of the Creative Commons. Jason's research touches upon issues of intellectual cultural properties and heritage making, and mostly in Native American communities throughout the United States, specifically in Oklahoma. He points out that the work of the Creative Commons tries to provide a greater number of options for rights holders. So why should listeners to the Artists and Ancestor podcast care about intellectual cultural property rights? Well, whether you're recording oral histories, writing down your family stories, or sharing your photographs, the Creative Commons allows you to protect your work while still making it available to the world. In this conversation, we talk about how this approach to sharing your creative and scholarly work can better serve future generations of both family members as well as researchers. So that's what we have lined up for you on this episode of the Artists and Ancestors podcast. Before we move on into our interview, I do want to say I really appreciate all the support that folks have been giving us on this podcast. If you like what you're hearing, please go on over to iTunes and leave us a favorable review there. That helps a lot to spread the word. So let's move on into our discussion with Jason Baird Jackson.
My name is Jason Jackson. I'm a professor here in the Department of Folklore and Ethnomusicology at Indiana University. I was a student here once long ago, but I came back to join the faculty from Oklahoma. My work had been in Oklahoma for about a decade, and I was a museum curator and a researcher and professor there. I taught at the University of Oklahoma and was a museum curator at a couple different museums in Oklahoma. My work focuses on expressive culture, the arts, festival, material culture, other topics related to traditional culture amongst Native American groups in the state of Oklahoma. Here at Indiana, I teach graduate students and undergraduates. I teach in the fields of Native American studies, museum studies, folklore in general, and also increasingly I work on issues of intellectual and cultural property as well as heritage policy.
What is intellectual property? What exactly is that?
Well, we know what property is, I think. Most folks in the Western world, at least, have a clear idea that, you know, in the modern world that we live in, land gets bought and sold, shovels get bought and sold, DVD players get bought and sold. And those are tangible forms of property, ones that could be owned, usually by individuals or by corporations. Sometimes the public owns land, right? If you think about national parks belonging to the people of the United States. But whether we're talking about a garden tool or a plot of land, we're talking about tangible property. Throughout human history, there have been things that have been thing-like stuff, which isn't tangible, but nonetheless really matters to people. We can think about songs or stories or festivals or rituals. Those are phenomena in the world, but they're not always tangible. You can't pick them up and put them into a basket. But sometimes those immaterial things are understood as ownable. Either they're owned by a group, or they're owned by a corporation, or they're owned by individuals. I mean, we live in a world in which intangible intellectual property really matters a tremendous amount. It's always mattered, of course, but it matters in new ways today. If we think about pharmaceuticals or engineering designs for cars or floor plans for houses or designs for the latest fashion. While those designs become physical things like pharmaceuticals or dresses, at a deeper level, they're ideas, they're creative ideas that somebody or some group of somebody's made. And while that some of them are new, some of them are really, really old. If we think about songs or folktales, those are also a kind of intangible cultural stuff. In some societies, those kinds of things like folktales and songs belong to everybody and nobody all at the same time. But we live in a time in which those kinds of creative properties, are increasingly owned, and sometimes they're very lucrative. So if we think about the film industry, the recording industry, new media, there are all kinds of people in the world who make a living trading in intangible cultural property. And so while such things have always been with us, they're a particularly prominent part of the world that all of us live in today.
And as time has moved forward, the laws concerning these properties have become more pronounced. And we're no longer just talking about what's legal here or what's legal there. We end up getting into sometimes legal and moral and ethical situations with who owns what.
Yes, and there are several layers to this. In all times and places, human beings have addressed these questions differently. There are different communities of people in the world who have different understandings of how this stuff is supposed to work. Those could emphasize private ownership. They could emphasize collective or communal ownership. They could emphasize national ownership. So that there's different ways to slice this pie. But things get more complicated still because we live in a time of change of two kinds. Technical change, for instance, has greatly shifted the ways in which we engage with these questions. So that it used to be that I would be hard-pressed to listen to a song from a society on the other side of the world. But in the internet age, it's not very difficult at all for me to have access to music from all around the world or photographs of activities and people all around the world. So that technological change has intensified our concern with these questions, and it's provided us with new opportunities as well as new problems. In addition to the fact that there's a technical change shaping the ways in which we today engage with the questions of intellectual property, there's also a changing legal and economic environment. As intellectual property has become more and more lucrative, it is more and more in the interests, financial interests of corporations, for instance, to promote and advocate for laws which tighten up the controls over intellectual property so that more and more of the world's stuff is formally subject to legal control through intellectual property law, and enforcement of that control through the courts, through criminal and civil prosecution, is more and more at an issue. We can talk about that in kind of grand abstract ways, but I think that everyone living in North America is familiar in an everyday life sort of way about these changes. On the technical side, we're exposed to all kinds of new media. But on the legal side, we're haunted by fears of accusations of piracy, and we're also faced with confusions, right? Am I allowed to make a photocopy of this or not? Can I use workbook sheets from this coloring book for my Sunday school class, right? We don't always know the answers to these questions because broad areas, kind of gray areas in legal terms have opened up. So one of the things that is being done to try to address that are projects like the Creative Commons, which aim to help people, everyday people, non-lawyers, learn how to work with in the current intellectual property landscape, at the same time providing tools to help people do the things they want to do and prevent some of the problems that arise from the ways that intellectual property law in particular has been changing.
Before we move into the Creative Commons, just to kind of recap, here in the United States, as well as much of the Western world and beyond, basically ideas of rights and ownership have fallen either, you're either in or you're out, on or off. And if it's in, then you have to argue on grounds of fair use. I'm just going to use this for my Sunday school class, not for money. It's only one copy, blah, blah, blah. And what the Creative Commons is really about, it seems to me, about finding another way forward, basically saying it doesn't have to be yes or no or in or out. And can you just talk about what the Creative Commons is and why we need it?
Yes, well, yeah, you framed it very well. The system that we've inherited has become, and it hasn't always been this way, but it's become rather binary. It's become one thing or the other. Those two poles, those two points, have names. Intellectual property is the way in which we talk about the one side of that coin. Things like copyright and patent and trademark are legal designations which say that somebody controls the rights to that phenomenon, and to use it, I've got to secure their permission. The other side of that coin is what's called the public domain. There's some cultural materials in the world which have been around for so long that they're either conventional knowledge, the idea that an umbrella can be used to keep dry during a rainstorm, right? Nobody owns that idea. It's been with us for a long time, and you don't have to go to special effort if you want to make your own umbrella. And there's a lot of cultural life that's still kind of public domain. But as a percentage of our human experience, the amount of our lives which are open and freely circulating outside of intellectual property restrictions is getting smaller. And the reason for that is that intellectual property laws covering things like copyright and trademark and patent, are becoming more expansive. More and more things in our world are subject to them, including some things which I think still surprise most of us, the idea that you can patent the human genome or that trademark law can attach to celebrities' identities. There's all kinds of ways in which new kinds of intellectual properties have been created. When they get created, usually that means that something that once was freely circulating has been enclosed by legal frameworks in which something that was available to me in the past as a product of my citizenship or as a product of just being a human being is closed to me now because it's an intellectual property that's owned by somebody. So what the Creative Commons is an example of, and there are others in the world, open source software would be another example of what we're talking about. These are strategies that are being devised by people, concerned people who want to change some of the terms in which we live our lives, to create new opportunities so that if intellectual property on the one hand and the public domain on the other can be stretched apart and a space be created between them, the Creative Commons would occupy that space. It's a system that's built on copyright law. It's not about abolishing copyright law. It's about using copyright law in a way that enables the people who make things, including all of us, to set the terms in which we share those creations with other people.
If I'm an artist, or if I'm a scholar, or if I'm a genealogist who's writing family histories, why should any of this matter to me? What is the point of this, and why should it be something that, at this point, I think almost everyone should be at least aware of?
One of the reasons to be aware of it is even if we do relatively little creating ourselves, we're oftentimes users of other people's creations. And so that we live in a time in which not becoming a pirate, not stealing other people's creations should be really important to all of us. If being a law-abiding citizen matters to you, then you should have some idea of what it is that you are or are not allowed to do with the things that other people create. The Creative Commons is exciting because it's a means by which creative people can set the terms by which they share the things that they make, but it's also a means by which those of us who would like to consume or listen to or engage with or reuse the stuff that other people have made can do so in a kind of clear way in which we know that we're using those materials the way that the creator has intended them and that we're not breaking any laws while we do so. So let me just say that I'm not affiliated with the Creative Commons as an organization, and they have wonderful resources for those who'd like to go beyond our conversation to learn more. And the place to do that is at the website creativecommons.org. They have a wonderful website which will step people through what the Creative Commons in particular is all about. So we can talk about it with a particular eye to the sorts of things that communities and artists and scholars of traditional art are interested in, but there's lots of resources online for people who would like to know more. So let me quickly answer your question about what to do, and then you follow up with some other examples. A simple way to think about this is that the Creative Commons marks the things that people, for those who use the Creative Commons as a set of tools, it enables us to very easily mark the things that we make with signs, with signals that show what it is that another person is allowed to do with that work. The logo for the Creative Commons is a good place to start thinking about this. Almost all of us are familiar with a C, a little C, inside a circle. That means copyright. And the Creative Commons has a logo which has two C's inside of a similar kind of circle. So Creative Commons, the logo for the Creative Commons looks a lot like, but is different from the copyright logo. When you see that logo, it's a sign that someone is making an effort to make that work available and usable to somebody else without all the hassle of hiring lawyers and tracking down owners to get permission.
And it's not necessarily something that is set up in a on or off situation that we were talking about. Everyone's copyright is still secured on everything that they make. Once your pen lifts up, once you've stopped talking on a recorder, once you finish playing the music or whatever, you still own your copyright. What they're doing is offering an alternative to that. And that alternative also is very flexible. Maybe without getting into the details, can you talk a little bit about that flexibility?
Absolutely. And the way to think about it is that it's additive to copyright. You're taking the existing copyright that you have in a work when you create it, and you are attaching a kind of post-it note to that work saying, hey, I have the copyright in this work, but I'm spelling out it with clarity in a way that doesn't require a lawyer to understand what kinds of uses I am and am not allowing you, the world, to use my work within. So if we think about copyright and public domain as two extremes, copyright doesn't go away, but we modify copyright through these what are called licenses. And we, in essence, fill in an expanding space between the public domain and copyright, unmodified copyright. So it could be that a person is extremely eager to share a work that they've created with the entire world, and they don't want any strings to attach whatsoever.
Grandpa's 100th birthday party video.
Exactly. We want the entire world to see, and we don't care if...
Especially part where his dentures fall
exactly.
out of the table.
We don't mind if it's in America's Funniest Home Videos. We don't mind if it's incorporated into the next major Hollywood motion picture. We just want it to get out there in the world. Well, one of the things that Creative Commons can do is, in essence, allow you to dedicate that work to the public domain. In other words, you can take it from copyright and you can pull it to the other end of the continuum and in essence, declare to the world that you created it and that you're willing to let everybody use it in any way whatsoever that they would want. Now, most creators would like to shape in some way the ways that other people might use their work. And so that what the Creative Commons tools do is allow us to specify in a more fine-grained way something short of that complete public domain dedication. The Creative Commons does provide a tool to do that, but there are other tools that address other issues. Anyone can check these out at the Creative Commons website, but let me characterize them really briefly. One aspect of this has to do with commercial use. It might be that you created a work and you don't mind who uses it as long as someone doesn't profit from it. In other words, you don't want your creative work to be a source of someone else's profits. So that if commercial or non-commercial motivations were your big factor, the Creative Commons provides licenses that can help you negotiate that aspect of the situation. Another has to do with attribution. And these are not mutually exclusive dimensions, they're additive. So you can be concerned or not with the commercial use or not of your work, but you can also be concerned with attribution. What attribution means is getting credit. In other words, your name being continuing to be associated with that creative work. So if you take a photograph of a community festival, right, you would love to see that photograph incorporated into next year's program for your community's festival, and you're not worried about making money on it because you know that the people who are going to want to use your photograph aren't going to have any money to pay anyway, and they're non-commercial just like you are, but you want your name to be attached to the photograph. You can specify through a Creative Commons license that you care about attribution and that you would like to be credited with all future uses of that work. That'd be another kind of matter that would follow along. Another concern that some people have is they don't mind who uses their work, but they're not so keen on the world, on someone else mixing their work with in some kind of complicated way with another work. This is called derivative works, right? So that creators of particular kinds of works may or may not have concerns about the kinds of derivatives that come from the thing they've created. They might be very eager for instance, an article that they've read to be circulated widely so that their ideas become widely known, but they're not eager to see that work cut up into lots of pieces and mixed in ways which they might find unpredictable or even worrisome. So, in a nutshell, the variety of licenses that the Creative Commons provides allows the creators of new works, whether those are musical or photographic or video or what have you, to specify how they do and don't want other people to use their works either as consumers of the work, readers, watchers, listeners, or as people who might go and take that work and use it in a new way, so that a photograph that might that you take might wind up on an album or CD cover, or it might show up in a community program, or it might be used in a documentary film or in a school classroom. These tools provide people with means by which to specify how the things that they create will be used or not used. On the flip side, for those of us who need the works of others, I mean, it helps us figure out what it is we are allowed to do or not allowed to do with things that other people have created. And while this is not only a matter for the digital environment, obviously the internet has made the desirability of these systems much greater.
Well, just the sheer fact that you no longer just have the one copy of a photograph or a handful of prints from it, but it literally can be iterated millions of times endlessly. All of this is really, really interesting and really fascinating. Let's move into some examples of this. Where would people maybe see this? I know I've seen this online at some very popular websites that people use. Maybe something like Flickr would be a good example of that.
Right. Flickr is a wonderful resource for those who are wanting to share the photographs that they make with not only friends and relatives, but with folks they've never met before. But it's also a place that those of us who might need photographs oftentimes turn looking for photographs. So that in my own work, for instance, recently I needed a photograph of buckets, right? Don't ask why I needed a photograph of buckets, but rather than taking a photograph of buckets myself, I went and looked on Flickr trying to find images of buckets. This was for a lecture I was doing. While I could search through all of Flickr, one of the things that Flickr allows me to do is to search only those images in which the photographers have specifically indicated that they're releasing their photos using Creative Commons licenses. What that means is I can quickly zero in on the kind of image that I'm interested in, but one that has been made usable to me through the attachment of a Creative Commons license by the photographer. Now, this has all kinds of advantages. One thing it means is that I don't have to go ask, find the photographer in the world, get them on the phone, and in a lawyerly-like way negotiate what it is I'm allowed to do or not do with their image. Instead, they've made it so much easier because they've explicitly told me what I can and can't do. And I can choose a particular image, not only because it's a compelling image, but because it's been marked in a way that tells me that it's safe for me to use in the way that I'm hoping to use it. So from a creative person's point of view, this greatly expands the number of people who engage with our work and who see our work. For a person like me, it enables me to know that I'm using a work safely. I'm not subjecting myself to accusations of piracy or to legal threat. And in essence, one of the things I can do is thank the photographer of that image, not only by using their work, but using it according to the terms that they wanted me to use it under.
And that could be with attribution or no attribution. Some people might not want to be recognized at all.
Exactly.
Being sensitive to those concerns.
Right.
I'm thinking of several other possible examples of this as well that I think might be important to people. I think about just the podcast that we're in right now, the fact that I have music at the beginning and then interludes in the middle and then at the end that's provided by Martin Simpson. I actually had to track down Martin Simpson in England, ask permission to use the recording, get his feedback back that was okay, and he had to grant me specific permission to use it for this, as long as I wasn't using it for commercial reasons and for educational purposes and all that. But I've since learned that there's music out there. I don't think any as good as Martin's. It's pretty awesome sounding stuff, I think. But there's music out there that people have offered up for the Creative Commons to be used through attribution or for non-commercial reasons. So if you're producing videos and you need soundtracks and that sort of thing, places like Podcast Alley, archive.org, are repositories where you might be able to find some of those things.
Your example helps us explicate two really important points. One is that the question of what would motivate someone to share this way. I think the idea of most of those who are involved in these kinds of activities at one level is communitarian, right? The idea that we don't want everything to be so locked up that we made music that nobody ever hears, or we created photos that no one ever gets to see or use. So that the idea is that where possible, people are choosing to contribute to a collective artistic and cultural heritage that they can both contribute to and draw upon. The notion here is the power of sharing, particularly sharing in situations where nobody is going to lose out in a commercial way. But that reminds us that there's another aspect to this, which is that if you, for instance, were to make a song available using the Creative Commons techniques, and you were to make it available, for instance, for non-commercial use, that doesn't preclude you from benefiting commercially. If a filmmaker, for instance, was going to make a major motion picture and also wanted to use your song, they're not barred from that, but the older terms are still in play. They've got to come to you and ask your permission, so that making something available for non-commercial purposes, for instance, using a Creative Commons license, it doesn't end the capacity for you to benefit commercially from that recording. So that if we think about the song that you're using for the podcast, the creator of that song would be in something like that position, right? They might use a Creative Commons license to enable a non-commercial podcast producer to use the song without having to track them down, but that doesn't preclude them making the song a profitable one from an economic point of view.
Well, I'm still a musician. As a former professional musician, one of the things that always bothered me was the binary that we talked about before. It was either in or it was out. You either contributed to the public domain or you had to enforce your copyright. It had to be one or the other. And you had to choose where that all was going to fall. And what it succeeded in doing was raising the bar to where people either resorted to piracy or they resorted to not doing really good and meaningful projects in the past. Yeah. So I think that we've moved into a really fruitful time. We're getting ready to run out of time here, but I wanted to talk just briefly about some other examples that people might be thinking about. We've talked a little bit about music. We've talked about family or photographs that you've created. How about some of those things that are in family collections? I'm thinking about my genealogists and local historians. Family photographs and those sorts of things. Maybe I want to put them on Flickr, or maybe I want to put them on the Internet Archive. Are there any guiding principles for dealing with that material, keeping in mind that I've just entered into a whole area that has to do with when it was produced, by whom it was produced, and trying to know what best practices are.
This is much trickier, right? One of the advantages of the Creative Commons that we've been speaking of it is that it makes things easier down the road for people who are in the sort of situation that you're describing in the present. So that if I create the photographs and I make very clear to my friends and family and everybody who's interested in them what the terms of with which those photos could be used are, in other words, I just attach a Creative Commons license to them before I put them in Flickr or put them on a family blog or in Facebook or wherever, I've made things much, much easier for my grandkids and relatives down the road to know what the status of those images are. In the case of inherited photos, if I open up a locker in my family attic and I'm looking at a set of prints or Kodachrome slides or something, the trickiness that all of this is attempting to address comes back into play, because presumably those prints or slides, I didn't make those images. And under U.S. Copyright law, as we know it now, it's the creator of images like that, in most instances, who has the copyright. Things get a little funny in places like, even more funny, in places like museums, right? If I take a photograph of a painting, right, I might have the rights to the photograph, but I don't have the right reproduction rights to the image that I'm taking in the photograph, so we're kind of at loggerheads. I'm not a lawyer, and now we're getting pretty deep into straight copyright law. So what I can say is that ownership is not the same thing as possessing copyright in the thing, right? Even if there's only one print in the world and you're its steward or custodian, that does mean you have a pretty powerful position because you're the one who, in essence, physically controls the only instance of that image. But it doesn't mean that you have the copyright in it unless that right somehow comes to you from the creator, right? And this doesn't have to be as painful as we're making it sound, right? I mean, if your mom and dad took the pictures and you've inherited them, for all intents and purposes, you have a lot of functional use rights in them. But technically, those rights have to come to you through a legal process of inheritance or something else. And again, I'm not an expert in that aspect of copyright law. The point to stress is that just because you own something doesn't mean that you have the intellectual property rights in it. You may have the physical property rights in it, but those are different things. And so there's two pieces of this. One is that we can find advice to help us negotiate these questions. There are websites and other resources that can be helpful in figuring some of this out. You raise an important question, which is when the image or work, the story, the poem, the photograph, the movie, the film strip, whatever it was, when it was made and what legal jurisdiction it was made in is a really crucial factor. And there are resources to help us sort out what the applicable laws and various points were. But then again, there's this reminder that as we make things ourselves in the present day, thinking about the status of those creations now will make the future uses that other people may want to make of them much more sort outable.
Well, I think that that's the reason I asked the question, was to take something just as, you know, grandma's shoebox of old pictures, and you quickly find out how complex it is. Anyone who's ever had a photographer do their wedding know that even though you're in the pictures, even though you paid for them to be there, they own the pictures. You know, if you start trying to use pictures taken at the Walmart Supercenter place, you'll quickly find that they hold the copyright on the pictures of you, even though you paid them to take them. You start getting into legal constructs. I think the overarching lesson out of all of this is the fact that we can set up systems to make data available for future generations. We can become good stewards of the knowledge that's part of our communities and parts of the groups that we belong to. And we also can just be doing those things that are morally right, not just legally right. Jason, I want to thank you again for being part of the Artists and Ancestors podcast. If folks want to track you down, what's the best way to reach you?
I'm pretty easy to find online. They can just search for me, Jason Baird Jackson, or they can go to a website that I have for my work, and there's contact information there. The address for that is Jason Baird Jackson. That's Jason, then Baird, my middle name, B-A-I-R-D, Jackson.com.
Great. Well, thanks again, Jason.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Artists and Ancestors with music by Martin Simpson and hosted by me, John Kay. I'd love to hear from the listeners out there to give me some ideas for future podcasts or folks to feature on the show. Let me know that you're listening out there. And until the next episode, keep up your research of the creative lives of people from the past.